From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Latest unemployment number down 5.9%. Job openings across the U.S. at a 13-year high. And yet, the big message for blue-collar workers across the country for years now has seemed glum. A big new survey by USA Today says, cheer up. Their special report projects 2.5 million new middle-skilled jobs in the next 3 years. Boomers retiring, new opportunities, without college and college debt. Is this for real? This hour On Point, the new blue-collar jobs and the future of America's labor force. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see? New wave of jobs on the way? Everything A-OK for middle-skilled, blue-collar Americans? Does that ring true in your line of work? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Jody Upton, senior database editor for USA Today. She managed the USA Today project, Where the Jobs Are. You can find a link to the study at our website, onpointradio.org. Jody Upton, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So what have you looked at and what have you found?
Well, as you said, 2.5 million blue-collar or middle-skill jobs is the first part of our series. We're also, later today, we're doing our piece on college-level jobs, and then we'll also look at low-skill jobs. But we started with these, what we're calling new blue-collar jobs, because it was the biggest surprise to us. Of those three categories, low, middle, and high skills, it's expected to be the largest growth over the next couple of years through 2017, with nearly 40% of the jobs created being in these blue-collar jobs. But they are not the same jobs that we typically think of as blue-collar. Almost 80% of them require at least some kind of training, whether it's a certification, a two-year community college job, or something. And it's very it's not spread evenly across the country. There are pockets where you can make $100,000 with a two-year degree out of a community college, and other places where you'll do well with $40,000 or $50,000 with a three-month training.
Jody, reel off for us a bunch of types of jobs that would fall in the category that you're talking about, these new blue-collar jobs, as you put it, middle-skill jobs. Give us a bunch of categories of job or jobs so that we can have a more concrete sense of what you're pointing toward.
Sure. Houston and Texas is one of the hot spots, and this has become because of the petroleum industry. One of the guys we profile is a kid who's 21. He's making almost $100,000 a year. He intended to go to school as an engineer and opted for an engineering tech job at a community college. And he is now what is called a process operator in the petroleum industry, which means he has to make sure the machines are running correctly. Another job that we're seeing a lot of are like CNC line operators, custom parts makers that use laser cutting machines, multi-million dollar machines. So all these are the kind of jobs that require some math skills, definitely some computer skills, and they're really not dirty. Construction workers, lighting experts, Atlanta in the film industry needs a lot of those. And a lot of general manufacturing in other parts of the country.
So are you talking here, are these also traditional blue-collar jobs? Is this carpentry? Is this plumbing? Is this electricians where skills are required and you need to know things, but it's not necessarily to do with college? Is it also those?
You definitely need a skill in almost all of these. And, yes, I'm talking about HVAC operators, the people that come and fix your furnace,
HVAC, air conditioning, heating.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of these require some skills. You're not, just going to be able to walk into, General Motors and get a job on the line anymore with no skills. You do have to come with something.
I see radiation therapists, elevator yes. installers and repairs. Yes. I don't know how many of those we need, but dental hygienists right. we need a lot. I mean, a lot of these jobs have been around for a long time, and yet we've had a blue-collar job crisis in recent years. So what changes the horizon? Why are we ballyhooing, hey, here come a whole lot of jobs? What's changed?
Well, I think a couple of things have changed. You're right. I think blue-collar jobs have dropped by about 35% since 1980. And some of those are coming back. But as the people we spoke to made it clear, they're coming back differently. They require more skills. You need more training for them. And there's a lot fewer of them. And in a lot of cases, they're tougher. So they are different, but on the other hand, we're also seeing a number of companies saying that their efforts to offshore jobs weren't as successful as they thought they were going to be. Either the labor turned out to be a little more expensive, or shipping was more expensive, or there's been enough automation that changed these jobs that made more sense to train people here in the U.S.
You're talking 2.5 million of these jobs by 2017. How much of that comes from boomers simply retiring and someone else needs to step in and do the work that they have for a long time done?
Well, some of it certainly will. I mean, there's a lot of baby boomers that will retire and will have a really big impact. But those aren't necessarily included in these. These are new jobs. So we also included in the interactive that we have online, you can look up not only the jobs that have at least a 5% or more growth of the 125 largest metros in the U.S., and what the educational level requirement is and what the expected income will be for that metro area, but also what percentage of that job is filled by someone 55 and over. And it may be an entirely different job than that 55-year-old person is doing right now.
If you've got 2.5 million new jobs coming then over the next 3 years, we're down to 5.9% unemployment right now. People look around the world and they're worried about Europe's economy. They're worried about China's economy. If those go south, I guess we would worry about our economy as well. But if 2.5 million new jobs come on, what does that suggest for the American unemployment rate? Can you draw some connection between them, Jody?
Well, I mean, this is not to say that we won't lose other jobs. We won't lose some of those more traditional jobs, that the jobs that the baby boomers are holding now simply won't be replaced. They will be different jobs. I can't predict what the unemployment rate might be, but I think everyone's hoping it will go a little bit lower than it is right now.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is if there are a bunch of middle-skill jobs coming online, new ones, what does it ultimately mean for the American workforce? Is this like, ooh, happy days are here again? Is this salvation on the way? Is this a cure for the slump in median income in this country?
I think I would put it more as cautious optimism in that, yes, there are a lot of jobs out there, but who's going to be ready for them? Are we training people into these jobs? Are we telling high school students or students who started a four-year degree and decided it wasn't for them and they are more deeply in debt than they wanted to be, are we telling them that there are options out there, that, you know, there are other things that they can do? And, you know, when did it become such a bad thing to work with your hands?
So this is a lot of this is personal. Part of this is public, what the big picture is going to be. But it's also speaking to individuals, thinking about their own careers, their own futures. Jody Upton with USA Today. There's a lot of work here. It's pretty terrific. You can link to it through our website, onpointradio.org. Jody, stand by in Washington. With me in the studio today, Barry Bluestone, labor economist and professor of political economy at Northeastern University, director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern. Barry, welcome back to One Point. Great to have you here.
Nice to be here again, Tom.
Is this it? Is this hallelujah? It's A-OK again for blue-collar America somehow?
Well, certainly in terms of jobs, we're seeing some very good numbers. And I recently suggested that with the growth of 200,000 jobs a month over the last 12 months.
Which we have seen.
If we can continue that, we'll be down to 5.5, 5.3, 5.2% unemployment, which most economists think is about full employment.
A lot of people on the sidelines.
A lot of people.
Not in the job market.
Right. Some of that's demographic. But also we're going to be seeing some of those people coming in. But I think Jody's study is very, very important because it's actually pointing to a demographic shift. About two-thirds of the job openings over the next decade, the newest numbers go out through 2022 from the Department of Labor, about two-thirds of those are going to be replacement workers because we have aging baby boom generation.
Replacing the boomers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The average age of manufacturer workers today is close to 51.
Wow.
And 10 years from now, most of them are going to be retired. The question is, do we have the right vocational education programs, the right community college programs to train replacement workers? Do we have guidance counselors that are leading young people who aren't ready for four-year college and probably – should not be going there. I teach at Northeastern. I shouldn't be saying that. But do we have the vocational schools ready to train the next generation to fill these replacement jobs as well as some of the growth we're going to have?
I want to look at the detail. I want to think about paths over time, your own path for a minute. But for listeners out there who may be in that sort of blue-collar zone and they're thinking, am I going to be all right in this zone, in my working life? If you're headed toward that job arena and you're 20 years old today, is the bottom line of all this that if you play your cards right, it's going to be okay? Because it has not seemed okay for a long time now.
In some industries, yes, the answer is you're going to be okay.
Which is a very unexpected answer.
That's right. In August of this year, just a couple months ago, the Department of Labor reports that there were 115,000 openings in construction nationwide, almost 300,000 openings in manufacturing jobs. And when we interview manufacturers around the country, we're finding their number one concern is finding trained workers who can operate a computerized numerical control machine, that CNC machine that Jody talked about, because these jobs are in manufacturing, but they're very different skill sets than when I worked in a Ford plant back in the 1960s building carburetors.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this out about the new blue-collar jobs, what they are, what they will be, what they'll pay, where you'll find them. Middle-skilled jobs are being described as, and we're testing these numbers, trying to picture the future for people who may not do 4 years of college or may and then turn back to blue-collar jobs, new blue-collar jobs. Anyway, Jody Upton is with us, senior database editor at USA Today. They have dug into all kinds of projections and come out with a number, 2.5 million new jobs by 2017 that they're calling the new blue-collar jobs in this country. Barry Bluestone is with us from Northeastern University, professor of political economy there. He's looked at this whole realm for a long time now. There's a lot of talk out there about it coming. Here's an interview with Minneapolis news station KARE. This is Eric Ajax, VP of Precision Parts Plant in Minneapolis. He says people don't realize that middle-skill jobs are a good opportunity.
I really feel that it's an issue of people not understanding the opportunity and the fact that our manufacturing plants are not dark, dirty, and dangerous assembly lines.
And they're begging for people. Here's the CEO of Chevron Phillips Chemical, Peter Sella, looking for middle-skilled talent, talking to USA Today.
This country is facing a shortage of that kind of talent. So the demand is there big time. What we need to work on is the supply.
Jody Upton, what are we talking about for pay here? For these 2.5 million jobs, what's it look like?
For the jobs that we included in our interactive and that we're talking about, we put a definition of livable wage based on an MIT study. And all of these jobs make at least $13 an hour. Many make quite a bit more than that. And so, a lot of these jobs also have overtime as an option, too.
So you've got a $13 an hour floor under this. So it's, are you judge? It's partly the skill required, and it's partly the wage that they make. $13 an hour is not exactly whoopee-tie-yay.
No, it's not. But again, it is a livable wage for the metro where the job is offered.
Barry, what do you see in terms of compensation if people go out and get the training for these jobs, whatever that might be? Do you see these delivering the middle-class life that we've talked so much about slipping away?
In some areas, absolutely, yes. In manufacturing jobs, you're seeing fairly good wages. You've got people coming out of vocational schools who within 3 years are making $60,000 to $70,000 a year. Certainly in the construction trades, truck driving, these are paying very well. But we also have traditional manufacturing, particularly in non-unionized sector. They're paying little more than the minimum wage, not a living wage at all. The other problem is that when I was a kid, I got a job at a Ford plant during the summer that put me way through school.
Even though you were on a college track, I'm guessing, but a lot of people worked in that realm before they were. So did I. You've got something sitting right here on the table that looks like it may come out of that period. Is that a carburetor?
This is a two-barrel carburetor from 1964. It went into a Mustang, and I had a good chance that I built that thing.
On a line in Michigan?
In Rawsonville, Michigan, back okay. in 1964, 65, and 66. But I was paid well enough that I got out of the university without debt. I had savings. Today, I happened to be at a McDonald's the other day, and I'm looking at a guy operating a fryolator.
Okay.
And he's going through exactly the same motions that I went through
on the
some
assembly
screws
line
into
building
this
carburetor for a Mustang.
But he's making one-fourth of what I made. The problem is a lot of the lower-wage jobs that still require those kinds of technical hand skills are paying very poorly. But in construction, truck driving, manufacturing, we do have a shortage, as a number of your guests have said, that I think is quite worrisome over the next decade.
So all in all, do you see more of those low-skill, low-wage jobs as a portion of American jobs now and coming, or is this middle-skill realm of work that Jody and USA Today are writing about, is it big enough, healthy enough, that we could have a familiar mix of work with a familiar, almost historic stature of middle-class life in this country?
If we go beyond the study that Jody has done so far and we look at the jobs that she's going to look at in the low-wage, low-skills, the latest Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers show that two-thirds of all the jobs created over the next decade will require no post-secondary education. They're jobs in hospitals, they're jobs in retail trade, in fast food restaurants. And the problem is they pay about half of what a college-educated kid would get coming right out of college. So we have a low-wage explosion. We do have some good middle-income jobs in the blue-collar crafts, in the blue-collar manufacturing. Those are good, but they're swamped by the huge number, 33.6 million new lower-wage, low-skill jobs that we'll have between now and 2022.
So, Jody, who do you picture getting these middle-skill jobs? Who's going to be positioned to pick up these better-paid jobs, sometimes paying as well as people are going to be paid after 4 years of college? Who will be positioned for those, Jody?
Well, I think it depends on what we do going forward in order to make sure that it's clear that these jobs are available. I think the target audience would be a lot of high school students that don't want to go directly into debt, maybe want to do exactly what Barry was talking about doing, earning some money before you go on to college. It might be people who have started a year or two of college and decided, this is too expensive, this is not for me right now, and I need some other option. But maybe I don't want to be a waitress or a bartender. Maybe I want to try something else. And I think that's probably a path we need to think about as being a little more common, that maybe right out of high school, this used to be the option with the military, maybe right out of high school, we get one of these jobs that takes 3 months or 6 months to do some training for, and then we go back and get our four-year degree, because I don't think there's anything in any of this study that suggests that education isn't a good thing. It's just what path is going to get you to a job.
There was a time, Barry, when American kids very widely, in your case, in mine as well, you just went automatically through industrial arts as part of an education. Is that what we're talking about here, sort of layering on top or coming out? Even if you're headed toward college, you may pick up, as Jody says, a several months training in something that will let you snag an income as you look forward to perhaps a different career?
I think you're exactly right, Tom. I mean, when I was going through high school in Detroit, I was college prep from day one, but I had 2 years of industrial drawing. I had a semester of machine shop, a semester of wood shop, a semester of print shop.
Yep.
Those skills have helped me all along. I still went on to college. I think it's also true that not everybody's going to go on to college, and they don't have to. If we can get the right kinds of science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM skills, if we can get guidance counselors in the high schools guiding some of these students into these high-paying craft blue-collar jobs, if we can get parents thinking about manufacturing not like Uncle Bob, who was in a sweatshop 30 years ago, but the new, modern, clean, high-tech manufacturing, many of these folks won't have to go to college at all, and they'll have very good middle-class living
but
standards.
But that can sound scary, because if you don't manage to grab one of those rungs on the ladder, there you are at the fryolator at $10 an hour, and you know that's a frightening prospect.
Absolutely. And I think what's happened is that we see the college degree as the only ticket to the middle class. I think what Jody's research is showing, what our research is showing, is there are other paths to the middle class, not for everyone, but for millions, and it will also help us solve a skills shortage that this country is going to have over the next decade.
We're going to hear in just a moment from Eric Brynjolfsson from MIT, who says, watch out, because there's a lot of automation that's going to sweep right through the middle of all this. Our callers first, Brendan in Florence, South Carolina. Hi, Brendan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. I was just going to give you a little bit of my life experience. I was brainwashed into believing that college was the only way to succeed.
Yep.
Got a BA in mass communications with a minor in English Lit, and okay. for 15 years I was never able to break $60,000 a year in management.
Yep.
I was laid off during a corporate reorganization, and I've always enjoyed working with my hands, so I became a pipe welder. And as a pipe welder, the worst year I've had is $120,000.
Double.
Working 58 to 60 hours a week. And the nuclear industry on outages, there's outages different places in the country where people are breaking $60 an hour with absolutely no college degree whatsoever.
Brendan, I'm so glad you've called. Speak to somebody who's out there listening, young man or woman, who's 19 years old, 20 years old. They're thinking about their future. You did the liberal arts path, the college path, and now you're a pipe welder. If they think they might have that inclination, that talent, what do you say to them, Brendan?
Well, I would explore grants. I actually went to welding school on a grant that was funded through the Department of Labor in conjunction with the power industries. And, if you can get in for even $1,000 a semester, $1,500 a semester, you can work full-time and take classes at night and see if you have the aptitude to do it. I mean, there are hazards that go along with it. You get burned occasionally and, things like that.
Yeah.
But for the amount of money, and I mean, realistically, in a 10-hour workday, in most places, between waiting for quality control to come do inspections and stuff, you might actually only work an hour or two a day.
Okay, there's the real lowdown. There's the real skinny from Brendan in South Carolina. Brendan, I'm glad you managed to double up there on that old income, 120 plus. People are that will perk people's ears up. I appreciate you calling. One more right here, Carol in Austin, Texas. Carol, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, how are you?
Okay.
I was wondering. Not wondering, but I have my statement. Is my husband and I both work in these skilled blue collar jobs.
Yeah. Okay.
We work full time, hard working. We can pay all the bills. But we can't put food on the table or gasoline in our cars.
I would think that food on the table and gas in the car should be part of the bills. I mean, that seems like necessary.
Exactly. But, we have electric, we have gas, we have rent paid, but we can't feed our family.
And you work in real estate, he works in IT. So what do you think when you hear people saying there's high-skill blue-collar jobs coming kind of to save the day? What's your reaction, Carol?
It's not going to save the day. You're going to have 2.5 million people in jobs where we can't pay our bills.
Carol, I appreciate your call. Jody, how do you respond to Brendan's success there in pipe welding, nuclear and the rest? Carol's saying, wait a minute, here's my experience.
Well, and I think it depends in part to what your expectations are. I mean, in the session that we're coming out with later today, we talk about the high-skill jobs. And there's a number of jobs that still require a four-year degree that do not provide a livable wage. I hate to say it, but radio announcers and reporters are on that list.
Great.
So there's a lot of jobs that are considered high skill that don't necessarily come with the income that we expect. But we're also talking to a lot of people, one woman in particular, Emily Cramble in the Minneapolis area. She was working at a gas station, and she wasn't making much money, and her house was repossessed, and she went through all of these things. She ended up calling the local Economic Development Commission, and they suggested, why don't you learn how to use this laser machine? And 3 months later, she was making mid-40s, and she's pretty happy with the way her life has turned around. So, it's really difficult to make these decisions based on anecdote. That's one of the reasons we tried to provide the
mm-hmm.
data.
Mm-hmm.
And people interpret those in their lives in very different ways.
Let me go to Trey in Joplin, Missouri. Trey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to share my experience with blue-collar jobs. I'm in my late 20s now. About 8 years ago, I started a job at a large snack food company. In a distribution center. It was a new satellite operation they were running to expand their operations.
Yep.
And I was able to get a good job there. I paid about $13, $14 an hour.
Yep.
I managed to keep the job there for almost 5 years. And I kind of hit a ceiling with advancement in the company. And then they decided to close down after only 5 years or 6 years of being open.
Okay.
and they lay about 40 people off.
Yeah.
So laid off, and then I got a job with another snack food company doing deliveries, and about 5 weeks, we liquidated. That would be Hostess, which everybody heard about that.
Sure, yeah. That's Twinkies and all the rest, yeah.
Yep. And then that actually opened up an opportunity for me to go to a two-year school for free, paid by the state and Hostess.
What have you studied there, Trey? What have you put your time into?
Well, I'm studying computer network support, so I'm going to be in the IT field.
How's it look?
Well, you know, it looks good other places, but not so much here in the Midwest. And my plan is to move to the Pacific Northwest, hopefully get something going there. But the point I wanted to get to is the fact that the wages are so stagnant and the gap between the rich and the poor is so large. And if you want to grow the economy and keep from having these recessions, I think that wages do need to come up, because that's when people are going to spend more money, and that's going to grow the economy, instead of paying all these people in their office, corner offices, a ton of money, and keeping the wages so low. I mean, the more you pay people, the more they're going to spend, and I think that's when the economy is really going to flourish.
Trey, I'm right with you, and I wish you the very best of luck on that move. If you make it, I hope things work out really well for you there. I mean, Barry, you hear both the determination there, it's gone from job to studying, ready to move, but there's also kind of weariness there and a kind of skepticism about, is this really going to work out for Trey and people like Trey?
Well, my great concern, Tom, is not so much the jobs anymore. That's a great concern. The problem we've had, and you've reported on it before, is the stagnation in wages for the last decade or more. And so what happens is that people are working harder and harder, just running to stay in the same place. You know, when I was a kid working in that Ford plant, I was represented by the UAW.
Yeah.
The auto workers
building
union,
this carburetor.
Building this carburetor. And that took a standard semi-skilled job and made it a middle-class family wage. We don't have that today. So that kid operating a fryolator obviously doesn't have the auto workers union behind them.
Yep.
Those wages have stagnated, and that's been true across the economy. Our productivity continues to grow, as your next guest is going to talk about, but wages aren't keeping pace with productivity growth.
So
and that's the problem that Trey has, that Brendan has, that Brendan used to have before he became a pipe welder, and millions of others.
When USA Today and Jody say that we've found middle-skilled jobs coming on in bunches here, I mean, and some of them pay quite well, but there was a time when you presumed that middle-skill would mean middle-class. Now, Barry?
In some cases, yes, the truck driver, the pipe welder, but too often. We have people, even with college, who are not making anywhere near what their parents made a generation ago. And that's because of the shift in the economy. We don't have the unionization. Minimum wages aren't as strong. Global competition, new technology. All of those things have led to wage stagnation, which is the real problem in our nation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point there. Sound from Nebraska as construction workers weld a big pipe together, pieces of pipe. We're talking this hour about the new blue-collar jobs, what they are, where they will be, what they'll pay, where you'll find them. USA Today has got a big report out saying 2.5 million by 2017. That's coming right up. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. The editor there, database editor at USA Today, Jody Upton, is with us from Washington. Barry Bluestone is here, labor economist from Northeastern University. Barry Bluestone, Jody Upton, please stand by. Eric Brynjolfsson joins us right now. He's a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management, director of MIT's Initiative on the Digital Economy. He is co-author of The Second Machine Age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Machines. Eric Brynjolfsson, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Great to be here, Tom.
We have talked with you a lot about robotics and how that's going to come into the labor market. Let me put it to you through a listener's comment, if I may, here, Eric, online.
Sure.
This is Rebecca, and she's listening and writing to us, says, my grandfather told me when I was little in the 80s that there were going to be too many chiefs and not enough Indians. He predicted that the best jobs to be had were going to be in the trades. My fiance will make close to $90,000 a year this year as an equipment operator. I'll be on my way to $40,000 as a hairdresser. The best thing is, almost no student loans. When our daughter is graduating high school, I'm most likely encouraging her to take up a trade first, then decide whether or not to go to college. There's Rebecca's view of the future and jobs. You're looking at automation and robotics. Does Rebecca's advice to her daughter make sense?
For some people, but unfortunately, I don't think it works for most people. I mean, I enjoyed reading Mary Jo's article. I like the optimistic tone, but the data tell a story that's not quite as encouraging. And I fear that we'd have a little complacency if we just think that those jobs are going to appear. The question is, are there going to be more jobs than people looking for them, or the other way around? And economics has a very easy test for answering that question, and that's the law of supply and demand. If you look at wages, you see that they're falling. We've heard that already from your other guests, that the median wage is lower now than it was 5 years ago. It's lower than it was 15 years ago. And that tells us that there is not enough demand for people working in those middle-skill jobs. I wish it wasn't the case, but the reality is that we've had a change from what happened historically for the previous century. And a big part of that is that technology has advanced much more rapidly than it did in the past.
Well, I want to look at how those economics are working, but if there is not the upward pressure on wages, how much of that is competition from the machine, the brilliant machine, as you describe them, Eric?
Well, there are a lot of factors. You know, there's globalization, but the one that we come down as seeing the biggest one is, in fact, the way that technology is advancing. And I was even surprised at how rapidly some of these things are happening. I mean, you may have heard earlier this week, Tesla is introducing a car with autopilot faster than I even expected. GM, Ford, and others are introducing similar cars.
What does that matter? Somebody still has to build the Tesla.
Yeah, but that means that there are people who used to be truck drivers or other kinds of drivers that are going to, in time, find that those kinds of skills aren't in demand anymore. And it's part of a broader trend of robots being able to do those kind of middle skill, manipulating the world kinds of tasks. In warehouses, Kiva, a company here in Boston, mm-hmm. is doing a lot of pick-and-pack types of operations. Baxter, another robotics company out of Boston, is working in factories for the equivalent of about $4 an hour, doing simple manipulating kinds of tasks. And these are advancing faster than I think a lot of us expected 5 or 10 years ago. And what I see going forward is that a lot more machines will be able to do those kinds of basic manipulating the world kinds of tasks. And that's going to put pressure on humans who are doing those same kinds of jobs.
Let's look at the numbers here. Jody Upton, you hear admiration for the outlook and yet skepticism about the pressure that robotics and automation will put on it. Did you factor that into your projections, Jody?
We didn't factor it specifically into the projections because we're looking at a much shorter time frame than even Barry was talking about. We're looking at in the next 3 years.
Yeah.
The part that we have coming out online October 28th is specifically about these low-skilled jobs and the likelihood of automation. And Mary Jo Webster, the main reporter on this, looked at some Oxford researchers who actually went through all of the SOC codes to figure out what is the probability of automation on some of these jobs. And while it will hit middle-skilled jobs pretty severely, we're looking at almost 70% of low-skilled jobs have a high probability of being automated in the next 10 years. But there's also high-skilled jobs that are at risk of that, too. One of the big ones that's made a lot of news is anesthesiologists for certain types of surgeries that are not, really worrisome, mm-hmm. you can use a robot for the anesthesiologist. So this kind of disruption isn't just for these middle-skill jobs. It's for everybody.
I don't know what to do with this. Eric, I mean, sounds like nowhere to run to, nowhere to hide. You know, go to med school, become an anesthesiologist. That used to be the high road to riches. Now it doesn't matter if you're on the fryolator or you're, I don't know, welding pipe or you're an anesthesiologist, all vulnerable?
I think there are a lot more jobs are vulnerable than used to be, and we do have to work hard. And that's one of the reasons that we wrote the book, is to bring more attention to the fact that this is happening faster. And it's not just in the future. We've already seen it in the past 10 years. It's been very disruptive. It's going to accelerate. We remain optimistic, Andrew McAfee and I, my co-author, because historically, people have figured out ways to create new industries, new jobs, and reskill. But the key is not to be complacent about it, that we can address this if we understand the magnitude of the challenge ahead of us. And there are things that people still have big edges in, a lot of interpersonal skills, interacting with other people, a lot of sophisticated cognitive tasks that aren't repetitive, that involve creativity, entrepreneurship. It's a big change coming down the pipeline, and it's going to affect people at all skill levels, as was mentioned. It's disproportionately right now affecting people in middle skills, which is why I was a little surprised at the tone of that article, because that's actually where we're having the biggest challenges. But it is affecting people across the spectrum.
What kind of middle skill jobs do you see as being affected right now by automation?
The ones that are most affected are the ones we call routine information processing skills. Things like, bookkeeping, accounting, clerical work, some kinds of routine factory work. Anything that's relatively repetitive, that's where the software engineers find the easiest time to write some machine code to do similar tasks.
Barry Bluestone, we don't want to be cruel here and get people sort of on a path where they get some technical training, go out, get in the job market. Jody's got a 3-year horizon on her big report here, and in the fourth year or the fifth or the sixth, boom, here comes Eric's robot and they're out of a job.
Well, I think Eric's right that, we've seen an acceleration in terms of the machine age. But even Amazon is not going to replace truck drivers with their drones delivering packages to my home in Cambridge.
Well, but Tesla's going to put autopilot up in the cab of that 18-wheeler and off it goes to San Diego.
I think we're still years and years away before we're going to replace all the truck drivers with autopilot. So this is coming. It's coming quickly. But there's still going to be years in the next 5 to 10 years in which we're going to need a lot of those skills. The other thing, and Jody's absolutely right, is that most of the growth, and Eric talks about that, are coming in fields that require personal care. 14 of the 30 occupations that the Department of Labor says will have the largest increase in employment are in healthcare and in personal services. You may be able to have a robot act as a nurse and maybe even as an anesthesiologist and perhaps even as a surgeon, but you're still going to need a lot of hands-on care, a lot of personal care. So I think what we're doing is we're moving from a machine age to a human age, a personal age, where people skills become very important in addition to those scientific, mathematical, engineering, and technical skills.
Let's get a call here from Chanute, Kansas. Justin's calling. Hi, Justin. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. My first comment, I wanted to comment on a previous caller who he had mentioned that he had become a pipe welder a few years ago.
Yeah.
And how lucrative it had been. I wanted to make a point that I worked as a welder and steel fabricator for 7 years.
Okay.
I did some pipe welding, but I mainly specialized in TIG welding with exotic metals, which is one of the most highly specialized types of welding.
Sounds good.
And something that he's not taking into account is that if you're willing to be on the road 8 to 10 months out of the year, then yes, you can make a lot of money and do very well doing that kind of work. However, if you're looking to have a family, such as myself, I'm a full-time single parent.
Yeah.
The manufacturing and industrial shops that you would be going into, the vast majority of them at this point, the wages are stagnant, the benefits are bad, and the conditions are even worse.
So you've got to be a road warrior in order to stay on the top of that wage arc.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound fun, but Justin, I appreciate your calling. Jody, have you factored that in? How much mobility are you presuming when we talk about how good these incomes could be?
Well, certainly in terms of where some of these jobs are located, mobility is key. I mean, Texas comes up over and over and over again as a job creator, especially when you've got companies like Exxon and Chevron who are building enormous plants. They're going to triple the output of petroleum-based plastics in the next few years. You've got what's going on in the Dakotas and, people that can, if they can get there, they may not even have housing, but if they can get there, they can make a lot of money. So there is mobility is definitely an issue, and it's perhaps more of an issue than it's ever been in these middle-skill jobs, that certain parts of the country have them. If you're a welder and if you're a precision welder, a TIG welder, as you mentioned, you might not want to head to Detroit.
A little slow right now, you're saying. Yeah.
Can be, yes.
We've got interesting questions on all sides. This. Jonathan writes to us, says, he takes your optimism, Jody, and he says, what does the blue-collar surge mean for those of us who are on a white-collar track. Is this at the expense of white collar jobs, are you suggesting, Jody? Is this going to be blue, not white, in 2017?
I think there's going to be a lot of adjustment. Certainly the whole team, while we were doing this story, we took a look at some of these jobs and some of these salaries and went, wait, what are we doing? There's a lot of reconsideration of what is the best path. There's a lot of jobs that are being reconfigured. Nursing is a perfect example of this, where currently I think about 40% of RNs have a BS degree. And there's a huge need for additional nurses. But a number of hospitals, including the Mayo Clinic, have said, you know what, we're not going to hire anyone without a BS degree anymore. It has to be, you have to have a BS, which is an example of a job that's sort of upskilling. And then you certainly have other jobs that, because of technology advancements, can become more routinized and can fall out of the upper
tier of this middle skill category that you're looking at. Allison in Nashville, Tennessee. Allison, thank you for calling. You're on.
Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest thing, and I know we're short on time, the biggest thing that I would love to see changed is the labels that we attach to everybody's position in life, blue collar, white collar, middle class, upper class. I think that's discouraging. And if you're a kid in high school and you know you don't have the funds to go to college, or you don't have somebody to support you and help you figure out how to get to college, that's not the end of the road for you. You know, you can go and work with an electrician company, and if you're entrepreneurial, you could end up owning the company down the road yourself. There are many, many ways to get to the end of the road, and I think when we label, we terrify, and we stagnate a very large population.
Allison, I take your point. Our time is short. Let me pick it right up. I mean, here's Noah writes to us. I trained on the job as a dental technician, and now I own my own laboratory. Barry, Allison says don't label. But on the other hand, there was a time when blue collar wasn't that derogatory. It was just what you did, and people made a fine living at it. I mean, coming up, I didn't think of blue collar as a put down. It was just a fact, and people made decent livings and raised good families.
Well, I still think for many blue-collar jobs, particularly those operating in the high-tech industry, these are very good jobs, and they're a place where some young people should think about going.
But are they, to Allison's point, are they discouraged because it doesn't sound fancy enough?
That's exactly the problem. We don't have guidance counselors who are trained in guiding people, young people, into these professions. And again, we have parents who remember what blue-collar jobs used to be. They're very different, in part because of the technology that Eric has talked about. They're clean. They're high-skill jobs in manufacturing.
Eric, I hear you there.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up another thing that Allison said, which she talked about, eventually owning the company. I think there's a trend towards a lot more entrepreneurship and flexibility at all levels, whether people have gone to college or not. And going forward, I think that's going to be one of the most important things we can encourage people to do, is to take charge of their own careers, to be flexible and constantly be looking for new ways to upgrade their skills. The days where you check into a job and you do the same thing working for an employer for 30, 40 years following instructions, those are gone because machines are very good at following instructions. What humans have an edge at is doing entrepreneurial, flexible, creative tasks, and that can happen in all different kinds of industries. Going forward, I think that's what the kind of economy we're going to be seeing a lot more of. Some might call it an Uber economy, but it's an economy where people are hustling a lot more. There isn't as much job security, and it's not as comfortable for a lot of people, but it's a much more dynamic kind of economy.
So you're giving advice to a 21-year-old or a 19-year-old, Eric, today, who maybe doesn't want to go to college or is skeptical of the value of a four-year degree, looking for something in this middle skill tier, where are you going to point them where a robot doesn't eat their lunch tomorrow morning?
Well, Barry mentioned earlier the interpersonal skills. I think those are big categories of jobs, whether it's teaching, nursing, personal services, personal trainers, but they all involve a lot more initiative than they used to have. That's something that people have an advantage in. I think we're going to have a more entrepreneurial economy, whether people like it or not. A lot of people aren't as comfortable with that kind of lifestyle. But the reality is that that's where the opportunity is going to be. So I would encourage people to take charge of their own careers, take charge of their lives, not be complacent and think that some employer is going to hire them and take care of them for the next few decades.
Jody, at USA Today, are your reporters there at the newspaper looking to jump out and go become itinerant pipe fitters?
We're keeping our eye on it, yeah.
Watch out. They may be gone, girl. Jody Upton, Senior Database Editor at USA Today. Thanks for all the reporting. We're following your whole series here with great interest, and we appreciate your being with us today, Jody.
Thank you.
Barry Bluestone at Northeastern University. It's always great to see you and your lovely carburetor, too, made by hand back in 19-well-something. Barry, great to have you. Thanks for coming.
Great to be here.
And Eric Brynjolfsson at MIT Sloan School. Always good to talk with you, Eric. Thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, good luck. Make a living one way or another. Go for it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.